Hello and welcome back to the London Magazine podcast. I'm Jamie Cameron, managing editor here at the magazine, and I'm joined for the first time by our new editorial and marketing assistant, Zadi Love. Zadi, hello, how are you?
Hello, I'm good.
We are also delighted to be joined by Joshua Jones, writer and artist from Llanelli, which I've kind of almost butchered, but I think just about the right way.
You nailed it that time.
Yeah, okay, nice, man. That's my Welsh credentials actually coming through. Swansea Jack. I will forego the extended bio, Josh, but we're here today to be talking about your book, Local Fires, which is a collection of interconnected short stories and your first work of fiction as well, and to have your first work of fiction shortlisted for both the Dylan Thomas Prize and the Polari First Book Prize is quite an achievement. Josh, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thank you. I'm feeling really good this morning.
Nice. You've come all the way from Cardiff, right?
I have. I've been up since like five already.
Yeah. and this is like the first day it's been snowing in the UK, for context for listeners later. So that's quite like a journey you've made.
It's raining heavy in Cardiff. But on the train, I was passing lots of snow.
Yeah. Before we kick things off, just with a short reading from Local Fires, I wanted to talk a bit about the place where these stories are set. Now, it's not surprising, given the title, obviously, that it's made up of stories that are very specific in the kind of their locality, that being Llanelli. So I was born and actually spent the first part of my childhood just down the road in Swansea. But I thought it might be nice for people who have never been to South Wales to get a sense of the place, perhaps, before you read. So how would you describe Llanelli in a few sentences, if I can give you that horrible task?
In one word, shit. If you'd asked me when I was a kid, I think my answer would be very different. Mm. My relationship with the town has changed year by year. It changed completely working on Local Fires. Growing up, I couldn't wait to leave. But every time I go home, I discover new things about it and love different aspects of it. In recent years, I've really connected with the nature more than I did when I was a kid. Mm. Going to the same places. But when I was a kid, I was going through the woods looking for a spot to drink. Now it can be a place of peace.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's really cool about this collection is that it is a record of the real place. I mean, you use real places in the book. There's pubs that really exist, right? I'm thinking of Half Moon particularly.
Yeah.
So on a final note before you read, I have a little bit of trivia for you to answer. So I actually went on the website for Half Moon, and if you can guess which three words they use as their tagline to describe their food and the kind of general ambience of the place, then you win the much coveted free subscription to the London Magazine. So there's three words. If you can get any of them, I'll be very impressed. If you get all three, then I would be astounded.
See, when I was going there, they didn't even do food.
Well, apparently their food is these three words now. I mean, they're incredibly generic, so
I reckon one of them is just good.
you're not that far from it. Yeah, maybe step up good slightly more intensely.
Great? Is great a word?
Great, it's not great.
I mean, a little more specific.
The first word that comes to mind is atmospheric. Can food be atmospheric?
Well, I'll put you out your misery and you can tell me what you think and whether this is a fair evaluation of the establishment. So fresh, local and delicious.
Oh, see, that makes sense, doesn't it?
I'm sold.
Have you had their food yet or not?
No, but my mum went like 2 weeks ago and thought it was nice.
Okay, well, there you go. So they're not lying.
If you had asked me some of the different names that the Half Moon had before it was the Half Moon, I would have got that.
What else has it been called?
It was the Half Moon, and then there was Robbie James, and then it was the Half Moon, and then it was something else, which I've forgotten now, and then became the Half Moon again. So
it's passed through many hands.
I think it's an emblem of the place as just having an identity crisis.
Yeah, evidently so. Anyway, if you are happy to now, it'd be great to hear you read a passage from Local Fires and give our listeners a bit of a taste of what the book's all about.
Sure. So I'm going to read an extra from the beginning and the end of Opportunity Street, which follows Jimmy Pooh as the central character, and he pops up throughout Local Fires. He's kind of the local con man and a bit of a drunk, but he sees himself as a bit of a ladies' man and a man about town. He owns a fireworks shop and he's raging because someone else is opening a rival fireworks shop in the same town. Jimmy Pooh marched down Opportunity Street with his fists clenched in the pockets of his leather jacket. He had been seething with rage, carrying it around with him like a padlock around his neck since he read the news in the Llanelli Star a few weeks ago. He strode past the Betfred gambling shop lit up like an amusement arcade. Through the front door, an old man could be seen with a folded newspaper, his hat pulled down over his eyes, circling bets on its pages of a red pen. And the works, its yellow and blue storefront fighting for attention against the Bernardo's green. Jimmy knew the guy behind the counter, a Bernardo's. He had one arm and a short temper. He passed the hairdressers for his pretentious window tint, the shadows on the other side of the glass with their heads in basins. Shadows that stared at their own reflections in the mirrors, their bodiless heads balancing on satin gowns. There were empty units on both sides of the street, big white cubes, house lights beaming, waiting for purpose. Jimmy rolled his shoulders to ease the tension simmering under the skin, the tendon stiff and rubbery, and stared at the brand new sign above the door of his destination with an intensity that could burn a hole for the PVC, Gary's fireworks. How fucking dare he? A vein throbbed at Jimmy's temples, whose thick and arrived pulsed like a worm. He could hardly think straight. The worm nibbled at his thoughts, leaving only the angry and the violent ones, the fun ones. His clenched fists were beginning to sweat in the leather. A bloody good sign, that. Bold. In your face. Dominant colours. Who does Gary think he is? The shop was nestled between an antiques dealer on one side and a YMCA shop on the other. There were houseplants, violently lush, in the windows of the flats above. Mannequins wearing military jackets and broadly helmets stood next to dark wood dresses adorned with binoculars, compasses, and old yellow newspapers in the windows of the antique shop. One of the mannequins held a rifle in his hand, probably a replica, but just as likely not to be. A man lounged outside on a green velvet desk chair, his feet resting on a box filled with film cameras and lenses. He was smoking a cigarette, reading an instruction manual on how to fly a Spitfire. The man seemed to not notice Jimmy, or the sign next to the door to the fireworks shop that read Grand Opening Today in gold paint. The O in opening was stylized to look like a Catherine wheel. Tacky. Such a good sign outside as well. There were banners and balloons strapped across the door and tacked onto the walls and the windows. People walked down the street with their bags for life and their eyes fixed on their feet. Jimmy watched the man as he flicked the ash from his cigarette. Why is he reading a book on how to fly a plane? Maybe he was hiding something. Jimmy staggered in the direction of the door, leaving Gary surrounded by boxes of colourful packaging, advertising explosives for family-friendly entertainment and discounted offers on seasonal holidays, and people who had run out of juice and now were quietly raising questions of pints. The air outside the shop was cooler now, the sun crestfallen behind a pocket of clouds, the street lamps not yet punching in for the night shift. The worm howled from under his skull. There was no moon. His vision was blurred at the edges. The houseplants in the windows of the flats above were black, their razored palms cutting a threatening figure from their nooks. The man outside had disappeared, and so had the furniture. The antique shop was empty, bar two mannequins in the window naked and missing limbs. Their blank faces watched Jimmy stumble out onto the street. He looked back at them, and the fireworks shop, and its door was closed. The lights off, window papered with tattered advertisements for a circus, a local talent show at the theatre, his ex-wife's face bleached and peeling. The PVC sign above the door of the shop that once boldly spelt Gary's fireworks in gold paint was faded, most of his letters missing. A pastiche of mail lay under the letterbox. There were no people, no celebrations, nothing to celebrate. The windows of the hairdressers were black, reflectionless. Through the window pane of Betfred's door, Jimmy could see the old man from earlier, sat in the dark and slowly circling bets on the paper. The strip of starless sky visible between the parallel rows of shops converged on Jimmy, their smashed glass cobweb formations looming large. All the units were empty, house lights hanging from a wire. The drywall ceiling panels black with mould and crumbling.
Thank you so much for that. I think clearly it's not just the pubs that have that sense of being real places, it's also the people and the characters in it. I'm very interested to know how much of these characters are tied to real individuals that you know, or how much you've attempted to just capture certain types of people that you find in towns like this, in these stories.
It's funny how much I can say without being sued. There's a character, Johnny Radio, and he's the titular character of the story, Johnny Radio. Johnny Radio is a real person, but I was like, decided to use his name because it's technically a nickname and you can't sue someone over a nickname.
Oh, so his nickname really is Johnny Radio?
Yeah. And he does walk around carrying a wireless radio in his arm, head to toe in Scarlett's, rugby merchandise, smoking king-size cigarettes. He actually passed away this year, so...
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, so RIP to the king. And the reason why I wanted to write specifically about him and use his name is that in every town and village, you know, you have characters, right? And they get blown out of proportion. You just see the visual of that person or like gossip. And I liked to imagine what his life actually might be like, which is when I started writing about him and in his story and imagining his whole past.
But it's quite a fine line, right? Because I'm thinking also of the story of The Fourth Wedding, the one that opens up the whole collection. There's this balance between how do I make these people real and also embrace the fact that they are absurd characters occasionally and funny characters, while also not crossing that line into kind of mockery or condescension, you know?
Yeah, I was really aware of that line, especially in that story, actually, because I wanted to pay attention to the way that people caricaturize themselves. Something I've been thinking about really recently as well is that you see a lot, like say on dating apps, for example, Instagram bios or whatever, people saying that they have an aesthetic but no personality and kind of making that their aesthetic. I've been thinking a lot about this of the self-aestheticization and the ways that people characterize themselves and wanting to draw attention to absurdity, but also going deeper than that and into the complexity of the lives that they're living.
Like in The Fourth Wedding, right, there's that extended bit where the character's reflecting on the Age of Bronze, which is like one of the most beautiful moments in the collection. And you have these serious internal lives of the characters cut off by the fact that her husband has just like farted in bed, right? Which is it's like quite a good summary, I think, of some of these stories. There's like the serious internal workings counteracted with just the absurdity of what all these characters are at the same time, you know?
Yeah. You know, I kind of grew up around laddishness and rugby clubs.
Yeah.
So when you have male bravado and laddishness, that doesn't mean that they don't have complexity in their daily lives and, you know, interests in art and culture and things.
Yeah, and I think you also have quite a lot of compassion. I mean, even Danny Jenkins gets a moment of vulnerability, which is quite impressive.
Yeah, I felt like I just couldn't have him like being a prick all the time.
It must be difficult to do.
Is it bad that I related to Danny Jenkins or something?
You need to have a look at yourself.
Yeah.
We've obviously got a lot of self-destructive narrators and characters in the collection, and the setting itself mirrors that. It's quite abrasive and gritty. I wanted to ask what it was like for you to be in the heads of so many characters and some difficult characters like Danny Jenkins. Did you sort of find writing from multiple perspectives daunting, or was it freeing to have the selection of so many POVs?
It didn't really feel that difficult. I'm diagnosed autistic and also have rampant ADHD. It just made sense to A, write short stories and write in a very sort of fragmentary way, and then B, writing from all sorts of, you know, different perspectives and older aged characters as well as younger people. And the sort of interlinking threads as well were difficult, because I would kind of comb through and I'd go on and work a bit on this story and then like, oh, this person should be in this person's story or like connected to this character somehow. So I'd go there and write something that would suggest that, and then go into the other story and tie that thread.
How did you actually approach that? Did you have like some massive matrix on the wall, like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia style?
I'd love that if it was that like that meme of Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny. No, I kept it all in my head. While I'm writing, now I've actually planned it a bit more, but it's been particularly riffy. I think about what I'm going to write for like weeks sometimes before I actually sit down and write it. I need the idea to sort of percolate for a bit first. And if it stays in my head and it's just there ticking away and going round and round, then I know that it's worth pursuing.
You've kind of mentioned this, the way in which your own neurodivergence is reflected in the style and form of the stories. It's not necessarily then a conscious thing. It is just my brain wants me to write in a kind of fragmentary way.
Yeah.
You know, that's just what I'm going to do.
I think quite fragmentary anyway. And, you know, usually when I'm chatting, then, you know, there's different tangents and then come back to this. And and it can be a bit of a maze.
Yeah.
So it feels quite natural to work with how I think and how I sort of experience the world around me. It's how I experience time and memory as well. It never feels linear. It's very fragmentary to me.
You have footnotes in your own kind of thoughts. That
I'm going to use that. Thank you.
I have that one for free. Yeah.
I guess to keep on that theme, in the story, How Would Clive Owen Feel?, which I think was maybe one of my favourites, the narrator, William, for the listeners who haven't read it yet, is at the doctor's being diagnosed for autism. And I was struck by the story because it made me think of the role of language in neurodivergent diagnosis. Because William, the character, seems to find the process of writing down how he feels, writing down how his mind works. He finds that a helpful task, but the language the doctor uses, the sort of diagnosis and the labels, he finds that a bit more anxiety inducing. So I wanted to ask if you find that language and writing is helpful to navigate neurodivergent identities, or are there some occasions when language is limiting or where words can't really apply?
I think I'll talk a little bit about how that story came about first, and then I think that might answer the question a bit as well. That's very much closely linked to my experience of going to the GP for the first time in seeking a diagnosis. I'd written, you know, like sort of 3 or 4 pages of A4 of all these reasons why I think I might be autistic. at the time, I didn't really know if I was autistic or ADHD or whatever. So I was just kind of seeking answers. I was worried because I think you only get like 20 minutes or so in a GP, right? So, you know, I was just like running through it, 200 miles an hour, absolutely like freaking out, really anxious. It took me 3 years, I think, to just pluck up the courage to even call a GP. I'd been wanting to do it for a really long time. And afterwards, you know, when I got put on the waiting list to meet with the autism diagnosis team, I was going around the UK quite a lot then and like just touring and performing poetry. And I would just read out that entire thing, like word for word, all the way through. There were a couple of times where people started crying.
Really?
I'd just be there like, what are you playing at? Like, why are you crying? Just having that sort of like emotional disconnect. And people were like, you've articulated how I've been wanting to talk about it. And instead of feeling connected with people, it just made me feel anxious and a bit guilty. And I was thinking about it. After a while, I just realised that it was essentially just shock tactics. There was nothing sort of creative or artistic about it. I was just bombarding people with all my inner thoughts, basically. So that's when I kind of took that and started writing How Clive Owen Feel and throwing it into more of a narrative.
How much of that original 3A4 pages or whatever made it into the actual story?
Quite a lot of it. Yeah. Like that whole sort of opening monologue. You know, I cut it down for brevity and you know, some of the rambling. I have a really bad habit of looking at Goodreads comments.
That is dangerous. Yeah. About your own work, I presume.
Yeah, I don't care about other people's work. And someone said on it that they hated that story. It's not even a story. But it felt kind of important to give language to an experience, and that feels like enough of a story in itself.
I agree with Zadie. I think that was one of my favourite stories in the collection. I think maybe even because it was so tied to your personal experience, not to say that you can't get in the mind of a 3 times divorced middle-aged woman or whatever else.
Yeah, she's based on one of my grandmothers.
Really?
Yeah. I think she's on like the fucking sixth wedding or something now. She's a bit of a gold digger.
I love that.
Okay, well, will we get an email from you? Can you please edit out that bit about when I call my granny a gold digger or whatever? And we will say no, we're not going to do it.
She doesn't read.
I also wanted to ask specifically about the Prolari Prize, one of two major prizes that you've been shortlisted for, no less. You told us just before we start recording that when the book was published, you didn't even have an agent.
Yeah.
And your expectations were, I mean, I'm not sure how you describe them, but low?
Yeah, I mean, realistically low.
Realistically low.
Yeah.
Proud of yourself, but not expecting to win the book or whatever.
Yeah. No, that's the next book. No, I thought my mum would read it, and my best friend was also my housemate.
You might get a piece in the Clinically Star or whatever.
Which doesn't even exist anymore.
Is it not? Oh.
No, it just got embedded into Wheels Online.
Oh. Did you get any coverage in Wheels Online?
I didn't, actually.
Oh. But isn't it kind of tabloidy, almost, Wheels Online, essentially?
You know, it's just like 80% adverts. I was unagented, came out with Parthian, and Parthian did a really great job of it, and they allowed me a lot of freedom with it as well.
Mm.
So I hired my favourite photographer in South Wales, and all of Wales, to be honest, to come and take pictures around Clonakilty in the hopes of taking a photograph of the front cover, which he did. His name's Nick Roche, and he's from Neath, Swansea area, so he's quite local as well.
My granddad's from Neath, yeah.
Maybe they know each other.
Hopefully. My granddad's on his fifth divorce now, and the gold digger's on now, I'm joking.
My gran was married to someone in Neath. Was he a chicken farmer by any chance?
He wasn't a chicken farmer. No, he wasn't from the big oil thing they have out in whatever it's called. Anyway, go on. Sorry.
It had maybe like 3 or 4 reviews. So yeah, then the Dylan Thomas Prize longlist happened. I got an agent off the back of the longlist, not even the shortlist, which is pretty cool.
Can you like recall the moment that you were told? Is it just you get an email saying, oh, by the way, this has happened? And you're like, what?
I got a voice message on WhatsApp.
Was that really? That's very postmodern, yeah.
Yeah, by my editor, Rob. He did a bit both times where, you know, he sent me like an 8-minute voice message. Uh-huh. 5 minutes of it would be him just walking around London, just talking about his day. And he's like, oh, you know, I'm really sorry I haven't got back to your email. I've been, you know, I've been here and there. Oh, by the way, you've been longlisted for the Dylan Thomas Prize. And anyway, so just drop it into the middle of his monologue.
Was there like a big reaction back home? What's the reaction been like generally to the book? Are you on the persona non grata kind of list now? Was it like, oh, he's exposed my behaviour at the cafe?
One of the reactions that I had, which I thought was quite interesting, and I'm not entirely sure how I feel about it. You know, some people were like, do it for Wheels, like be on the shortlist for Wheels. I'm like, I don't want to be sort of representative of a nation state.
In that way. It's a principality or whatever.
I think that there's been a bit of frustration that there hasn't been a Welsh winner since the first one, which was Rachel Trusaze. There hasn't been a Welsh winner since. There's hardly been any people on the shortlist from Wales since. So there was quite a few people who were potentially excited at having
an actual Welsh winner. Yeah.
Again, yeah. So sorry to disappoint them. But I also think it's amazing that we have one of the biggest literary prizes in the world is in Wales, and it's at Swansea University, and it meant that my parents could come.
Yeah.
Because they're only 20 minutes away.
Nice. I guess to follow up about the prizes, the Polari Prize is obviously for a book that explores the LGBTQ plus experience. And queerness is a theme or even a direct subject in many of these stories. One of the queer characters in the story, Bertie, asks the question, how can I be trans and queer in a place like this? There's nowhere to dance. And so I wanted to ask you if you could tell us about what it was like growing up queer in Clonakilty.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that retrospectively. I didn't realise my queerness and my life within and my identity within that until years later, until I was, you know, in sort of early 20s. Yeah, I've been thinking retrospectively on that, and I think I didn't necessarily have the language to explore that side of my identity. I had a general sense of being stifled and restless, and I was very angry. And I wasn't sure why I felt angry. And I think that was one of the reasons why. And it also ties in into being neurodivergent as well. I didn't get diagnosed until I was 22, I think. I'm almost 28 now. And I went through all of school, college, university without any extra support, which is frustrating because I would have done better at school. Yeah. So there's these significant parts of my identity and how I navigated the world that I just didn't even know or have the language for. But I had trans cousins and LGBTQ plus family members and friends in school that I always connected to. I wasn't entirely sure why. Or it's been quite interesting, the amount of people that I was friendly with who have been diagnosed autistic with ADHD since and have come out as queer since. See, there's like a real gang of us. But it's interesting, you know, looking back, having an affinity with certain people, but not knowing why you feel this sort of intrinsic closeness with them.
Yeah, so I guess there was a lot of sort of anger and frustration at when you were growing up, you didn't know why.
Yeah.
In returning to those stories, was that almost getting to write what you maybe couldn't at the time because you didn't have the words, but you have the words now.
Yeah, and that's why I always say that, like, I felt like I kind of needed to write the stories in Local Fires to exercise all of that. I've reconnected with a bunch of people that I grew up with, and it's been healing in a way. Or at least sort of, yeah, changed my perception of the place a lot.
Speaking of anger, by the way, one of the things that I really enjoyed in the collection was some of the kind of references to other texts and to pop culture. You've got Graham Greene, Donnie Darko, which might be the ultimate kind of angry teenager film, which I was very happy to see. Like Descartes, obviously Clive Owen and Children of Men. Even, I was especially delighted to see Joan of Arc, the kind of Midwestern emo math rock band. This is the first time I've ever seen this in a Dylan Thomas like nominated collection.
Oh, I have a funny story about that.
About Joan of Arc?
Yeah, so this is going to sound like a complete humble brag, but there is a point to this. After the Dylan Thomas Prize shortlisting and everything, and obviously being on there with Catherine Lacey, who I'm like a mega fan of, we became quite friendly afterwards. And I recently went to America to do a poetry tour, and I went to Chicago. But beforehand, I was emailing her and asked if, you know, if she had recommendations and stuff. And she was like, oh, let me put you in touch with some friends of mine in Chicago. And I ended up staying at Tim Kinsella's apartment for free nights.
Are you serious? You're going to tell me you went to go see the American Football House soon as well?
No, I wish.
It's an Airbnb now. Have you heard that?
That's in
Champagne.
Yeah, which is a little further out.
Yeah.
I think the train might go through it. I can't remember. But yeah, I ended up just going to bars and art galleries with Tim Kinsella.
Was Mike
and
there as well, or is he?
No, I didn't meet Mike. But with Tim and his wife Jenny, who've got a band together called Tim Kinsella and Jenny Boss. I was like trying so hard to play it cool, the entire time. I gave him a copy of Local Fires as thanks, and I completely forgot that there's a Joan of Arc reference in there. So it's like, oh fuck, he's gonna read that. And just know the entire time I'm like this lame ass
fanboy.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to ask on the back of that, and how deliberate are you with the references? Are you just kind of writing what comes into your head, or are you trying to lay a map of all your influences in some higher level way?
There's no distinction for me between, you know, a rodent statue and
Joan of Arc.
And Joan of Arc and Kim Woodburn's How Clean Is Your House?
Yeah.
And how I'm feeling and what I'm listening to or the media that I engage with really influences what I write about. When I was writing Howard Clive Owen Feel, I did get a bit hyper-focused on Clive Owen films. And Children of Men is one of the best films ever made. I'll die on that hill. And it also got me thinking about how the stoicism of Clive Owen's characters in pretty much every film that he's in creates this interesting framework between William Williams trying to open himself up and be vulnerable, but, you know, struggling with alexithymia, struggling with the regulation of emotions and knowing how to respond and perceive emotions in others. So, you know, he's looking towards a male figure, a stoic figure, on how to regulate and respond to emotion. So I try to be really intentional with my references and make sure that, you know, they are continuing the work or responding to the work in some way. Where that comes from, I think, I really like John Ashbery's poetry and sort of New York School Who.
Hyper-referential, those guys.
Yeah. And my way into writing fiction was through poetry, so it kind of made sense to do that.
Clive Owen is officially a neurodivergent icon, is that
also it helps that he's just like impeccably beautiful.
Yeah, he is. I always think of that scene at the end. Is it the end of Born Identity where he like has a random cameo and he's also really stoic in that? He's just kind of like dying in this field. He's like, look what they make us give. You know, it's actually a profound scene. So I'm with you, man.
I don't know why, but I always think about the second half of Children of Men. He's in flip flops and it's just like, you know, all these like people die in explosions. And
he's got a pair of Crocs on there.
It's just like flip-flops and a long cord. Yeah. And I just felt like that expresses the stoicism and the absurdity.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, as a final question, touch on a few things there maybe that you were enjoying at the time, but we like to ask all our guests what they've been enjoying recently. So it could be an album, film, book, artwork, or a bit of everything. But what have you been loving recently?
Oh my God, there's so many. I'd try and do one of each.
Cool.
Oh, okay, here we go then.
So I really loved the Thinking About Gladys machine by Mario Levaro, recently republished by And Other Stories. I recently loved a film called Mad God, directed by Phil Tippett. That's a stop animation horror film that took him like 30 years to make. The attention to detail is just crazy. An album, let's go a portable model by Joan of Arc.
There we go.
So I listened to that twice today already.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, on the train.
Love it. If there's anything else, any other shout outs, final, this is your last chance.
I'm good.
Okay, perfect. Okay, well, you can find us at The London Magazine on Instagram or at The London Mag on Twitter, and also probably an equivalent of that on Blue Sky at some point soon. You can also subscribe to the magazine for just £40 a year. That's 6 print issues to your door for £40. You can also pre-order our new December and January issue just by itself too, all on our website at thelondonmagazine.org. Zadi, Josh, thank you very much, and shout out to Tim Cancella and Joan of Arc and Mike as well.
Oh, and actually, go see Tim and Jenny on tour with Dive in December.
In the UK?
Yeah, they're currently in Europe, and at the end of the month and early December, they're going to be in the UK, so check them out.
We're going to see like a huge spike in like geographic, you know, Chicago, Illinois, Champaign, Illinois.
Yeah.
All these people are going to be suddenly listening and reading the London magazine, so.
Great.
I'm glad to hear
thank
it.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's the crossover that you didn't expect.
Exactly. Okay, thank you, and we'll see you all soon.
Good, thank you very much.